Unto them I'm now calling.
Amen.
I thought about stealing something from a friend of mine this evening. He likes to introduce himself by saying, I'm Tracy and I'm a grateful alcoholic, but not grateful enough. Mm-hmm. And I like that, but I gave him credit for it and didn't steal it. But I know where he's coming from with that. I love to hear that, and it reminds me that I don't know that I can ever be grateful enough for the journey that AA has given me. Out of the place that I was in 9 years ago, the life that has germinated and grown and come to the place where I can stand in front of you and share my experience and what happened and what life is like now, it's pretty unbelievable to me, and I hope I can convey that to you in a way that makes some sense. I'm not the world's greatest speaker, but I'm grateful for the opportunity to do this. And so I'd like to go back to 1981 when I was 18 years old. It was late in the month of May, and I was sitting in an addiction counselor's office. And there was a reason, of course, for my being there. A few months earlier, I had been involved in a drug and alcohol-related incident at school. I guess to be completely truthful, I wasn't just involved. I and a buddy of mine were the ones who made it happen. And there were a lot of people involved. And so I had received my expulsion papers. And the school administration had told me that they really didn't want me back. I mean, I was told that by the principal of the school. However, there was a new program in the county at that time for first offenders, and I was entitled to it, whether the principal wanted me to have that opportunity or not. I was entitled to it. And the way that would work is certain things were required, and if I fulfilled my obligations there to the satisfaction of the school board, I could finish my schoolwork and get my diploma. And that involved a few things. It involved some service work around the school, but more importantly, it involved group counseling, group therapy, and also individual counseling. And so I was in this guy's office, and it was our last scheduled meeting. And despite everything that was going on in my life, I had been successful enough as a student to have been accepted to a university. My last year and a half in school had been a disaster academically, but nonetheless, my performance before had been sufficient that I had been accepted to a college. And so this was my last meeting with the counselor, and he was a good guy. He was a good guy. You know, when I met him, my life was really imploding on me. Things at home were not good, as you can imagine. Things had come to a point where my father had said, "You're 18 now, you're an adult in the eyes of the law. Hopefully you can get your diploma, and once you've gotten your diploma, I want you out, and you can go out and find your own way." I knew I deserved that. There's been an awful lot of dishonesty, there's been a lot of unhappiness in our house. And I think dear mom had something to do with talking him back some. I never heard the whole story, but later he came back and he said, "Well, we're going to put you through school on the condition that you never fall below a 3.0 and you keep your nose clean." He said, "I mean 3.0. If it's 2.99, you're on your own." So I said, "Okay, that's not going to complain with that." But so here I was in this guy's office, and he was saying to me, "I hope you will continue with the work we have started because I think you are an addict, and if you don't do something about it, it's going to get worse. I had been honest with this guy. Coming into that situation with him, I had already made up my mind. I need to be honest with somebody because I haven't been honest with anybody in a long time. And it's gotten me in a lot of trouble. I decided I was going to be frank with this guy. I answer his questions honestly. I do remember one thing that he asked me one time. He said, if these things that you do cause you so much pain, why do you keep doing them? And I did not, at that time, have an answer for him, other than to say, I don't know. I don't know. I can look back on it now, and I have a pretty good idea. Things have changed. I know a lot more about alcoholism, about addiction in general. I know a lot more now. I might give a different answer if I were, to see him again, talk to him again. But at that time, I didn't know what was driving me. But we parted company that day, and at that point, I had been clean and sober, using that loosely. I'd been clean and sober at that time for about 30 days. And with him, he had a calendar for me. He'd pull it out of his desk, put it up, and he would ask, are you still clean? And if I said yes, he would put X's on the days. And he said, probably around 30 days or so, your mind's going to be a lot clearer. You'll have an idea of what it's like to be straight. And I actually was looking forward to that because I could not remember a time since I was 14 years old when I had been straight for more than a few days. I was bench drinking when I was 14. I was smoking pot when I was 15. And then before I was 17, I was doing hard stuff. About the only thing that I would not do was use a needle for things. I was afraid of needles. I didn't like it. Anything else, though, I was willing to do. So I do want to say to you, I greatly respect the singleness of purpose that we have in this program. We're about alcoholism and recovery from alcohol. So you're not going to hear me talk about drugs anymore this evening, but I just want you to know that that was there, very much there. And in the years to come, anytime alcohol was there, usually other things were too. So I just want you to know that. But I'll say this also. Drugs were what taught me dependency in the first place, but it was alcohol that gave me the final defeat. And that was nothing that I ever expected, because in those days I thought that alcohol was a toy. I thought that the other stuff was the serious stuff. I looked at alcohol as almost something like refreshments, almost like Kool-Aid. It was unfortunately hard to get, but always found a way. So I and the counselor parted ways, and I told him that my life had improved so much just in those 30 days that I thought, there's no reason for me to go back to that life. There's no reason for me to do that again. I feel confident that I'm good now. And I was good for about 2 months. But I got to college, and at that time, the drinking age for beer was 18. I was away from home. I don't have to tell you what happened. I mean, you can guess. I went crazy. Academics were, at best, a second or third priority for me. But the fact that I could walk into an establishment on Franklin Street, Chapel Hill, and order pitcher and belly up to the bar and be a real drinker, I like that a lot. I like that a lot. And when I did study, a lot of times it was sitting at the bar, and I knew what the specials were around town. This one had the draft special on Tuesday. This one's got the Little Kings, three for $5. I knew where to go to study and drink. one point I lived in a fraternity house, and it was there that I learned the delight of having an ice keg waiting for you in the shower in the morning. We called it a fraternity house, but really what it was just a bunch of guys that liked to be inebriated, and some of the brothers there worked at a place that sold kegs, rented out kegs, whatever. And it worked out great for us because if a keg were returned like half empty, or sometimes almost nothing had been taken out, the guys would just bring it to the fraternity house, and we'd have it on ice, and wake up in the morning and wiping the sleep out of your eyes, and you walk into the shower, and there's a keg of iced beer. And so I learned the delights of drinking in the morning there. I won't say a great deal about the college experience. I think you can see where that went. I do want to say that a wonderful thing that did happen to me was I met the girl that I married. It's my senior year, and I was absolutely astonished one day. I was walking around campus and I was in a deep depression. Depression is something that acute chronic depression runs in my family for generations, that and bipolar disorder. And I did not escape that myself. I knew better than to do the things I was doing. My mother once said to me, do you not realize that you're pouring a depressant on top of depression? And I remember saying to her, I do know that, I am aware of that, but the thing is, for whatever relief it gives me, it's worth it, whether it's only an hour or two, but it's worth it for me to escape, the depression for a little bit of time. But it just so happened that I was at the end of my college career and I heard someone call out my name, and there was Margaret. And we became quick friends. We both liked to do the same kinds of things. She was one of the few people I'd ever known that could keep up with me drinking, which I thought was pretty impressive for a girl. And we were married about a year from the time that we met. And we went off to, make our fortune. And fast forward a little bit, we had moved to this area. About 7 years into our marriage, and Margaret, I hope you don't mind my sharing this, but about 7 years into our marriage, one night Margaret came home and said that she needed to have a serious talk with me. And we had been going through, I'll call them growing pains in our marriage. We had some rough spots. And so when she said that, I wasn't sure what was coming. I didn't know if she was going to say that I've had enough of you, or I'm moving out. I didn't know. But what she said was that she had decided she didn't want to die an alcoholic death. And she thought that's where things might be heading. And my reaction to that was not what I would call supportive. My reaction to that was, wait a minute, that those weren't the terms of our marriage. This was, we're partiers, we party together, this is what we do. But I could see that was, I could see that something was changing drastically, dramatically right then, and she told me that in this program, people get sponsors, and you go to meetings and you do these things, and my head was just exploding. And, I think I made it pretty clear that, if you want to go on that journey, that's fine, but I don't have any reason to do that. So she set off on her sobriety journey. All the while, my drinking had been snowballing, I put it that way. Had built up a huge tolerance to alcohol over the years. I could drink more and more and need more and more. I mean, gotten to the point where it was hard, it was about hard liquor. I didn't have time for the light stuff. And, I could put quite a bit of it away without really being impaired as far as I could tell. So I was continuing on that path, and I was aware that Margaret was gone many nights, and I knew she was going to meetings. And it put me in a weird place, but mostly what I did is I was a workaholic in my career. I knew no boundaries for work, work all the time. I was in the IT business. We were early adopters of remote working, so I could work all the time. I could fire up the VPN at home and log into the server room, and I could continue working into the night, and many times that's what I did with a glass of bourbon at my side, bottomless glass of bourbon. So fast forward again to around, I would say 2012, maybe. And the way that my drinking looked at that point was it had become an all-day thing. It was fully integrated into my life, you might say. Sometimes in the morning when Margaret was up in the bathroom in the shower getting ready for work, I would slip downstairs and I would take a couple of good slugs off the bottle. I liked gin in the summer and bourbon in the winter. And so I would take a couple of good slugs and then set off on my hour commute to Newport News. And I liked that a lot. I felt like I was a much nicer guy if I drank in the morning. I was much easier to be around. I could handle the stresses at work better. And then there was an ABC store about 5 minutes from the building. And because I had a managerial job, I didn't have to account for my time exactly. And we had many branches, so it was easy for me to work in visits to the liquor store when I was, heading to this branch or that, troubleshooting meetings. I could hide the alcohol inside of that. There were a couple of embarrassing incidents during that time. And dear Margaret, used to pack my lunch for me in hopes that I would eat a healthy lunch instead of going to a fast food place. And I think more than once I forgot that I had left my little knit bottles, those little airplane bottles you get, that I had left those in my lunch bag. Because I like to go to the ABC store and get a few of those and put together a concoction. I would go to McDonald's first, get a big drink, pour the drink out so I still had the ice, pour the liquor in there, mix it up, put the lid on, straw, I'm good. Go back to the office. I assume nobody could smell it. No one would notice. I don't know. But sometimes, to my own surprise, I would realize at 4:35 in the evening that I was drunk. I had managed to get myself drunk on the job, and that kind of surprised me. And it happened a few times that what I had to do, I'd get out on Jefferson Avenue. It's very heavy traffic out. I'd get out there and realize, man, I'm pretty good and wasted. And I would go over to the Walmart parking lot, park way in the back. There's some trees and some shade. And I would park and I would just lean back and hang out there for a while until I felt like it was okay to get back on the road and go home. Get home, of course, I can tell you that there were times, unfortunately, when, if Margaret was home before me, she would be standing there ready for a hug and a kiss. But I needed to get to the liquor cabinet first. That was urgent. Almost knocked her out of the way one time, making a beeline for the cabinet. And from there, it would be the bottomless glass all evening. And another thing that started happening, which even I thought was a little peculiar, is that I would wake up pretty regularly around 2:33 in the morning and need to drink. And even though I had, rationalized away all the other stuff, I'm sure some people drink on the job and maybe have a little buzz when they leave. I would rationalize that kind of thing, but The idea that I was having to regularly get up in the middle of the night to drink did strike me as being a little peculiar. But that's what I was doing. And then in the morning, of course, we start the thing again. My last drinking incident happened when Margaret was going out of town for a long weekend. And I laid in supplies. I love Margaret, love her company, but I gotta tell you that in those days, if she was gonna be going away for a while, I made a little party all by myself. I didn't like drinking at bars, that kind of thing. I like to drink by myself, and always did. I was a very, very isolated person that way. And so Margaret was going off for a few nights and laid in some alcohol. The idea was not that I was going to be drunk all day long for several days. The idea was that I'll just go out a little bit more than I usually do. This is a special occasion. And so one of the things that I had was a half gallon of Bombay Sapphire Gin, which was one of my favorite things. So I had the other backup stuff, the Rolling Rock, and all that kind of good stuff. But the gin was the good stuff. And I remember, I think it was a Saturday night, and the plan was, I like watching old war movies, old black and white movies, so I queued up a few that I wanted to watch and started drinking. And this is not a joke. The last thing I remember as far as the movies were concerned is I was watching The Longest Day. And it was a long day. It was a very long day. Somewhere around midnight or 1 a.m., I lose track of the whole thing. All I know is that the next afternoon, I woke up downstairs and I looked over on the kitchen counter, and there was that half gallon bottle with about an inch left in the bottom. And it stunned me to see that. And my first thought was, oh my God, Margaret came home in the middle of the night unexpectedly, and she saw the gin and couldn't help herself, and she drank my gin, and she might be upstairs passed out in the bedroom. Now, you think I'm kidding, but this really happened. So I went over and I looked out the front window, and her car was not there. So that apparently was not the explanation. And then I had another thought that was a little frightening. I thought someone broke into the house, and they might still be here. They broke in and they drank my liquor, and they could still be in this house. And of course, I didn't find anybody in any of the closets or anything like that. And then it dawned on me, this is what your life has come to. That was the moment. That was the day. This is what it's come to. You're insane with alcohol. You're so impaired. You have no grasp on reality at all. And I realized I needed to do something. And my impulse was to go to Amazon.com and find a book. And I did. And I found a book called Alan Carr's Way to Control Alcohol. And it told you how to do that. It told you how to control alcohol. And part of that was you need to understand what a toxin this is. And this stuff will kill you. It's poison. And once you've internalized that, once you know that this stuff is really bad and poison, then you'll be able to control yourself. And that sounded plausible to me. And so Margaret came home. Was it Monday? It was Sunday, okay, came from Sunday. And my head was reeling about all of this. And I told her, I have something to tell you this time. And I said, I think I want to quit drinking. And she was, she was intrigued. And we talked about that some more. I think she had the idea that there's some opportunity was unfolding there, and she very calmly, we engaged in a conversation, and I told her I had this book, Of course, it never occurred to me that she had books on our bookshelf, you know, AA books there. That never occurred to me. But I told her what I had. She read some of it. Said, well, that's interesting stuff. And so one evening she said, well, my experience has been that it's a lot easier to stay away from alcohol if you don't have it in the house. So, you know, I had quite the collection in the cabinet there, all kinds of good stuff. Some of it, the seals weren't even broken. She said, are you ready to pour it out? And, you know, the heart, you know, it's like, this is bad, you know. Said, yeah, I reckon so. And we stood there and we poured gallons, I guess, down the drain. So I had a feeling that this is different from other times. This is different from the other 1,000 times that I said I was going to quit drinking. So she kind of let me find my way for a while. About 2 weeks later, I was about to climb the walls. I knew that what was coming was more drinking. I could feel it. And it was frightening to me. I didn't realize over all those years of drinking just what a hold it had on me. And I'd heard people talk about craving before, and I didn't really know what craving was because I never stopped drinking long enough to have the craving. It was just when I wanted to drink, I drank. And to not have my alcohol, I mean, I was having the shakes, I was, you know, not sleeping well. It was uncomfortable physically, and it was uncomfortable mentally. And so, you know, Margaret could see that I was in some duress. And one night she said, I'm going to the neighborhood meeting, which happened to be the one at St. Andrews on Route 17. So I'm going to the neighborhood meeting. You want to come along? And for some reason I said yes. And so I went to that meeting and I sat as far in the back as I could. It was upsetting to me to think that I was there because I might need to be there. That was really upsetting to me. And then an interesting thing happened. She came up to me with a gentleman and said, I have someone I'd like you to meet. And there's a guy, many of you know, actually, but here's this guy, he's clean cut, he's got a good haircut, he's, you know, wearing a nice shirt, he's, you know, obviously come from work, and gave me a big smile and a big handshake, and said, what's going on, man? And I said, it just came out of my mouth, I said, I've been drinking for a long time, and I'm not sure I can stop. So he said, oh, okay. He pulled out his wallet, a piece of paper, wrote his name and phone number on there, and gave it to me. He said, if you ever want to talk about what's going on in your life, give me a call. And I remember thinking, there's no way I'm ever calling you. I'm not calling you. But for some reason, I stuck it in my wallet and got home, and I thought about it for a day or so, and I called him up one morning around 9 o'clock in the morning and said, there's a Panera down in Harborview, do you know it? And I said, yeah, I know that place, so I'll be there in an hour. So we got together there, and by the time I got there, my face was, and my eyes were stinging from tears, from crying. This everything was, in my view, my world's blowing up, you know. This is, instead of seeing this as the beginning of something, I saw it as the end. You know, this is the ultimate defeat, that I'm actually going to go and talk to a person from AA, you know. And he bought me a cup of coffee, and we were there in that public place. I was so self-conscious, I was a mess. And so we started talking, and, you know, there were some questions. He heard my story, I heard his. At one point he said, got a question for you, have you had enough? Are you done? I didn't have to think about it very long, to tell you the truth. I surprised myself. I said, I can't do this anymore. Didn't answer the question directly to begin with. So I can't do this anymore. I said, are you done? I said, yes, I'm done. And talk a little bit more, and he asked me if I knew the word altruism. I said, yeah, I know that word. He said, well, this is an altruistic program, and if you want to do what we do, I will be there with you every step of the way. But if you aren't ready to do this, that's okay too. But I'd rather you tell me sooner rather than later, because there are other people who need help. I felt like that was pretty blunt. I was expecting to have my head pad and somebody say, it's all going to be okay, man. It's all going to be good. But that's not how it was. It's kind of firm. And then he asked me, are you willing to go to any length to achieve victory over alcohol? And I had a rare moment of honesty there too, because I thought about it and said, I don't know. That's a tall order. And I said, I don't know what you're going to ask me to do. I mean, I think I said something really ridiculous, like, you know, what if you asked me to walk down Main Street in a chicken suit or something like that? He said, come on, man. We're not going to ask you to do anything that we haven't done. It's like, okay. So we parted ways. He said, well, you know, give me a call if you think it over and you want to do something. So I went home and went up to our bedroom, and I lay down on the floor and I curled up in the fetal position and I cried like I've never cried in my life. And if you've ever cried in a way that it actually hurt, that's the way I was crying that afternoon. And I guess for me, it was my ego being crushed that I had made the decision to seek help from someone, because that's not the kind of person I was. I was a do-it-yourself, do-it-to-yourself kind of person. You know, I'll find my own way. I don't ask for favors. I don't do favors. That's the kind of person I was. And so it hurt a great deal to be asking anybody for help. But I believe it was, I think it was the next day when that was over, a calm came over me. It really did. A calm came over me. I had this sense that something was telling me it's real this time. You've got to move forward. And I called him and I said, what do we do now? And he said, well, home group meeting is Friends of Bill W., Allen Providence Road. Meet me there and we'll discuss a plan of recovery. So I did that. And through all of this, my head's just reeling. I mean, it's just, I'm living in a different dimension, a different world. That's the way it felt to me. And we got there and the plan was, it included meetings, of course. And what I was hoping I was going to hear was that it was like other clubs and things that I'd been in over the years. Like, we get together once a month and have an hour meeting. And I was like, well, so the way we do this, I'm going to ask you to do 6 meetings a week. And you're a married man, so I'll give you Sunday off, you know, so you can have some time with your wife. But I might ask you to double up occasionally, too. It's like, so I'm sitting there on the outside. I'm going, okay, but on the inside, I'm going, are you freaking insane? 6 meetings a week? What the, you know? And but that's what was happening on the inside. On the outside, I'm like, okay. And for the first 30 days, we were just going to get to know each other. We were going to get together, have dinner, talk. And we did that. We started getting to know each other, and I was attending meetings. And we got into the book after 30 days. And all during this time, you know, I was kind of surprised at how withdrawal is. You know, I thought withdrawal would be over pretty quickly, but I was still shaking at that time. I look back at my handwriting and I could hardly read it. You know, I was just, my nervous system was messed up. And so I was still getting cleaned out, and that was kind of the purpose of those first 30 days of just go to meetings. We talk every day. One of the things that he asked me at our first meeting was how I was with faith and spirituality. And I told him, you know, that, you know, at one time I had left the church. I was raised in the Baptist church, and at one point I'd got angry at the church and I stormed out and I said I would never go back. But something happened a few years before I came to AA and it convinced me that there was a power greater than myself that wanted to have a relationship with me to the extent that I would allow it. I had an experience. I can't explain it or describe it. I'll just tell you, I knew. I knew after that experience that God was there, what I call my higher power, and always had been. And so I was able to tell this man, I do believe. I do believe. And he said, well, that's good because that's one less obstacle you've got. Some people find that to be a little difficult in this program. That's one thing you don't have to do. And that was true. So we started working the book, started reading together, and I remember so clearly, you know, getting into the doctor's opinion, which became one of my favorite chapters of any book I've ever read. I love the doctor's opinion. To me, not only does it tell me what I am, but it's a story of hope. Especially those last, you know, the descriptions of those two men, what they had come to, their lives hanging by a thread, and they got new lives. They got new lives and new meaning. And I thought, I remember at the time thinking, man, could that happen to me? Could that possibly happen to me? One time he asked me, what would you like to get out of this program? And we had been reading Dr. Silkworth's letter where Dr. Silkworth says about these new AAs that you can rely on anything that they say about themselves. And that really struck me. That struck me hard because I wanted to be honest again. I'd lived in lies for so long, and I was so tired of lying and dishonesty. And I remember telling him, I said, well, other than to get alcohol out of my life, that's the main thing I want to do, but I think it would be really great if I could ever have anybody else say about me to rely on anything that he says about himself. So that would be great. And he said, well, I can't promise you anything. I can't promise you anything in this program, but I can pretty well assure you that if you do the things that we do and you apply yourselves to the yourself to the steps, that this will happen, that this will come in time, and it's doable. So we went on through the steps. I became a home group member at Friends of Bill W. I got volunteered for my first service. That was a good thing. I needed to be volunteered. I'm not the kind of guy who's going to put his hand up and volunteer for anything. And my first position was the supplies position. And one of the things that involved was, you know, lining up the cakes for the birthday celebrations and making sure you have the plates and forks and all that good stuff and ice cream. And so my self-confidence had fallen so far. I can't tell you how my life had been hollowed out by alcohol. I had no faith or confidence in myself. I didn't even know if I could handle that job. It was a big deal to have that responsibility. Now, this is a guy who had been the head of IT for a pretty good-sized credit union and responsible job, but what alcohol had done to me is made me so I couldn't even, I wasn't even sure I could make the coffee right. So I remember the first time that it was, you know, time to order a cake, and I went down to the food line, and I had drawn a picture of what I wanted on the cake, and the employee there looked at it and said, is this a corporate symbol? And I said, well, yeah, I think it is. He said, well, we can't put that on cakes unless you have a letter of permission from the corporation. Like, so I'm going, oh, God, you know, I just thought I was coming here for a cake, and you know, someone's talking to me about, you know, a letter from the corporation. So then I said, I think other people have done this before. Is there a manager here? You know? And so she went and got the person. She came out, and she looked at it. She said to the employee, I know what this is. It's okay. So she looked at me and she said, yeah, I know what this is. We can handle this for you. So that's a good thing. So over the months that followed, I got to know that lady. And she would ask me when I would come in, she'd say, still sober? Yep. She told me that her father had been in AA for a number of years, and that they were the best years of her family's life. So I recall she said about 8 years that he was in it, and she talked about how wonderful it had been. But then he went out, and she looked at me and said, "You stay in. You stay in it." And every month, I remember telling her, I'm going to pick up my one-year medallion. And she hugged me right there in the store. And, this is the kind of stuff that was happening. You know, my first year of sobriety, this kind of stuff's happening all over the place today. I'm learning to be honest. I'm learning to care about other people. I never cared about anybody. I cared about Margaret. I cared about my parents, yes. But, you know, other people didn't care. And I started noticing that some of the people who came in with me, you know, around the same time, I was very happy for them that they were having the same thing that I was having. We were starting to feel better. Things were happening in our lives, and we were getting cleaned up. And so one of the proudest nights of my life, really, truly, was that night of the one-year anniversary for me. And very proud that, you know, my sponsor got up there and he said some things, but the thing that really made me proud, and I think it was okay to have that kind of pride, but he said, I think this could be the first guy I've ever worked with who did everything I told him to do. That was huge for me because most of my life I prided myself on not doing what people asked me to do. And that's a fact. You know, I mean, I looked for ways to take shortcuts, to cheat, to do whatever I could do. But on this particular thing, I really wanted what you had. I realized I did. I wanted to be different from the person I had been. And it was becoming real clear. I'm really grateful that this man was about discipline. We talked about that. So he said, "I believe that alcoholics need discipline." And I don't know how it is for other people, but I knew that that was true for me. And we established some disciplines. And one of the best, of course, was the morning routine, as I call it. And you all probably know what that is, but that was rigid. You know, if I called him and he asked me, "Have you done your morning ring?" I said, "No, just be clip. His phone just go dead." So I knew, you know, go do it, call again. But no one has to tell me to do that anymore these days. It is so fundamental to my well-being. Now, as soon as my eyes are open and I've got a swallow or two of coffee in me, I sit down. I have that reading. I've got a pile of books. I'll just pick one or two and just read from them. I don't read anything cover to cover. I just pick something up and start reading. I do that, and I pray. And praying has changed for me over the years a lot. I can tell you that in this program, not only did I learn how to pray, but I learned how to grow in prayer. My prayers are different from what they were in the beginning. My prayers, my prayer time these days is mostly about gratitude. That's really what my prayer is about, because like I said at the beginning, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, but I'm not grateful enough. So most of my prayer time now is about saying thank you, counting the blessings. It's almost impossible for me to count all the blessings in my life. In fact, I think it is impossible for me to do that, but it's worth trying to do that. And I lessen, and things come to me, not in words, but in feelings. And sometimes I know that I'm not maintaining my spiritual condition as well as I have at other times. I'll be honest with you, I mean, my sobriety path is not a straight upward line. You know, I've had little ups and downs and, you know, side journeys and all kinds of things have happened, but I'm still in this thing and I still believe it. And You know, some people talk about life getting lifey sometimes, and life's gotten lifey for me a few times over the years. There was cancer, there were all kinds of things going on. And the things that I've learned, we like to talk about them here as tools, the toolkit. It's as good a word as any, I think. Those tools are there. And I remember this man who brought me in said to me one time with regard to faith, he said, a time is going to come when the only thing between you and a drink is going to be your higher power, and that is not the moment to get to know him. That's a good thing to live by. It's a good thing to remember, because I know that that is true about myself. I can tell you right now, if I make it to the 26th of this month, that'll be 9 years for me. But I'll tell you right now, if I were to take a single shot of alcohol, I know myself well enough to tell you that would be the end of the game. Because I know how my mind works. And in my mind, what would happen is I would say, well, I had almost 9 years of sobriety, but that's over now. So off we go to the races. That's how it would be. I know that. I know myself better now than I did 9 years ago. That's for sure. I want to say that there are things that enrich my sobriety, and one of those things is working with other men. I was taught the traditional way: men help men, women help women. Many women in the program I love. I love mixed meetings. I love men's meetings are great, but I love having both men and women in a meeting hall, because to me that's how family is. In this world we need to know how to have wholesome relationships with both men and women. That's the way I see it. And so I love being in a mixed group. But working with other men, our founders knew what they were talking about. There's nothing like it. If you haven't had that experience, I will just tell you that it will it'll supercharge your program. And if you have had that experience, you know what I'm talking about. It gets to the point with me where I don't refer to these men very often as sponsees, because what they really have become in my life is just guys that I talk with about alcoholism. Talk about life as a recovering alcoholic. Oh yes, we work the steps, we talk about the steps, we talk about what's going on in our lives and how we try to apply what we've learned and what we know. But really what it comes down to are the guys who know me well and I know them well. And it's hard to tell people to do things that you're not doing yourself. So, as when you're sponsoring someone, it gives you good opportunity to do some self-examination and see how your program's standing up to. So working with other people makes my program more productive and more rewarding. I talk about getting a new life. Well, it's so much. I remember one night I was here early on, like probably in my first 90 days or so. One night I was complaining about all the meetings. And a guy turned around and laughed, and he said, don't worry, man, it'll become a way of life. And I remember thinking, I don't want this way of life. I just want to stop drinking. Well, I will tell you that it is my way of life. Almost all the people that I think of as my friends are in these rooms. I feel pretty certain that if I got myself in a crack, almost anyone, any number I had, I could call it, and they would be there for me. That's the way I feel. And I feel that I would do the same for them. That's a big change for me. When Margaret and I are traveling now, we use that meeting app and we find a meeting. And sometimes I sit in those meetings and I think, this is just still so bizarre to me that I'm here. And I've been sober these years now. I never thought I could ever have a sober life. Tried so many times, made such an ass of myself so many times, and here I am. And we'll go to these meetings, and they'll know where the good places are to eat in town. We've been invited to go dine with people. We had the good fortune of visiting Portugal a few months ago. And one day, we were ready for a meeting. We found an English-speaking meeting. And we went there, and a lot of people who were there were speaking English, but it was their second language. I wish I had a second language, but I don't. But and after that meeting, they said, well, there's a museum down the street. There's a cafeteria downstairs. And what we do is whoever wants to, we get down there and get some food. And then we go out on the lawn. There's a river out back. And we get some tables together, and we just have a meeting after the meeting. And that's what we did. And I remember sitting there just thinking, this is freaking believable. This is unbelievable. I'm in another country. I'm with these people. I've never seen them before, and yet they are family. They are family. They understand we're not a glum lot. There was a lot of laughing and people enjoying each other. There were some people who were very fresh, very new, and they were getting some guidance. I'll put it that way, getting some guidance there. So it was all happening right there. So I want to just leave you with the idea that. These things, the promises that we read at the end of the things, I used to think that it has to be a load. It has to be a load of BS. That can't really happen. Those promises, I mean, I know everybody likes to say it, but that can't really. They do happen. Sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. But if they've worked for anybody, they've worked for me. And I can look anybody in the eye and say that to them and mean it, and they know I mean it. I'm very honest, but I say, if you do the things that you do, we all do, you stay with it, you know, you may go up, down, sideways, but you keep coming back, and those promises will come true for you, and there's nothing else I know of that will do it. That's all I've got. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, sir.